Okay. I think this is our last session, I believe. And Esty asked me to do something about Hanukkah, which I'm very happy to do. Yes. I blame you for everything.
Yeah.
And therefore, it really is, important for us to get a few interesting insights. There will be a little bit of halacha in here as well, but it's mostly perhaps a slightly different take on how this works. The standard approach that people tend to learn is the Greeks were, you know, evil and bad and tried to kill us, and we resisted and succeeded
and won.
So let's all eat donuts. Yeah.
Who's talking about that? Still true.
That is still true. That is still true. That is still true. We still do eat donuts. No, it is still true. The Greeks represent very much a source and a force of negativity that we're going to see soon. On the other hand, I think that the picture is actually a little bit more complex than that. And the Greeks also represent a source and a force of great positivity. And how to integrate these two without just labelling the Greeks as the eternal enemy is what I want to try and look at today. And that will, at the end of the day, touch a little bit on where you hashgraphically stand in today's world. I don't think it's a coincidence that the labelling of the Greeks and Greek intellectualism as the enemy of the Jewish people is part of the whole worldview, is a part of the whole Weltanschauung of suspicion of secular education and a negativity of secular education. It's much less likely to be found perhaps in the world of YU, etc., etc. But we'll see a little bit how that works and see if we can get a balanced view. It's always hard to try and find a balanced view. Kol ha'olam kolo geshet tsar ma'od. So the truth always lies on a very narrow bridge. The either side of that bridge is a oblivion, as it were. So let's have a look at what we have to say here. I want to really talk about two things. One of them is light, which obviously is the theme of the festival. And one of them also is Greek wisdom, which also is a sub-theme of the festival. I only recently found out that the modern Hebrew reference to Hanukkah as Chag Ha'urim, the festival of lights, which I always assumed to be a very modern secular take on Hanukkah, is actually a very old expression. It's not particularly a rabbinic expression, but I think it's actually found in Sefer HaMakabim, or something of that nature, or another one of the sources. I can't remember. Maybe it wasn't Sefer HaMakabim, but I found it in a very old source. I need to check that out. But it wasn't just a modern Israeli secular invention. Please come and take a seat. And light is definitely very much part of the essence of the festival. So let's have a look with the source one straight away. One of the interesting sources on Hanukkah is Sefer HaMakabim. Sefer HaMakabim falls in that slight limbo zone between the end of the Tanakh and the beginning of the rabbinic writings, the Mishnah and the Gemara, etc., etc. It's in a set of books that the Catholics call the Apocrypha, okay, which are the books basically which were written during the Second Temple period. Some of them were written by Jews, some of them were written by non-Jews, some of them are with Ruach HaKodesh, some of them are definitely not. We do not have them as part of our Tanakh, and yet we do draw from them sometimes, depending on which they are, like the Sefer HaMakabim when it comes to Hanukkah. So just so that you're aware of that, it's not the kind of thing that most people have on their shelves, but it's out there. Number one, Bereishis bara Elokim. Let's start at the beginning, okay? Bereishis bara Elokim es ha'shamayim ve'es ha'aretz. So in the beginning, God is creating the world. The first thing we see about the world is it's dark. Okay? But there was a Ruach Elohim, Elohim, hovering somehow in the world. And then we're going to see what this Ruach Elohim does with this darkness. And like I said, the very first psukim in the Torah, you have, if you like, this standoff between this Ruach Elohim and the fact that there was an ambient choshech. Darkness. Vayomer Elokim yehi or, let there be light, and I've emphasized the word light because it appears five times in these few lines. Yehi or, vayehi or, vayar Elokim es ha'or ki tov, the light was good. Vayavdel Elokim bein ha'or ubein ha'choshech, and Hashem made a havdalah. So the first thing you see here is havdalah between light and dark. That's the Ruach Elokim creating this havdalah, this separation. Vayikra Elokim la'or yom, and God call the day light, the light day rather. And the darkness was called night. That's the first day. Now, this light, of course, was not natural light. That's quite clear, because the sun and the moon, as we see from the creation story, were only fixed in their places on day 4 of creation. And Rashi immediately comes and says, Vayar Elokim es ha'or ki toy v'yavdel, Hashem separates this light. Says Rashi, Ra'ohu she'eino kedai lihishtamesh by Rishayim. This light was a light which was not fitting to be used by the Rishayim, people who are Rishayim, evil. And this light was retained, was put aside for the tzaddikim. Okay? So you see already this light is a light of spirituality. It's a spiritual light, it's not a physical light. There was no physical light, the sun, the moon, etc. It's a light which is for tzaddikim and not for Rishayim. That's just clear. So far all this is very standard, you'll have learned all this at some stage. Interesting Yerushalmi says number 3. Shloshim v'sheish sha'os. For 36 hours, Shimsha Oisa Ha'oira, that light was used, Shenivres for Yom HaRishon, which was created on the first day. This light from the first day was used for 36 hours. How so? Shemesh Rebe Erev Shabbos, 12 hours on Erev Shabbos. And this is interesting. This light didn't even get used till Erev Shabbos. Why? Because Adam HaRishon wasn't there. Adam and Chava weren't there till Erev Shabbos. So Erev Shabbos, they had 12 hours. Shemesh Rebe Leil Shabbos, and 12 hours of the night of Shabbos. So you can see, again, it's not a physical light. They're using it through Erev Shabbos and Leil Shabbos. V'shtemesh Rebe Shabbos, and 12 hours on Shabbos. V'haya ha'adam arishan mabit boi misoif ha'olam ad soif. And this light was used by Adam HaRishon to look from one side of the world to the other. Again, this is not a physical thing, not some kind of mega telescope. This is obviously, we know, we see already this light is not physical light. It's first of all, it's only for the tzaddikim. Second of all, it's burning all the way through the night, etc. And it's only set aside later used by the tzaddikim. It's meaning, this medrash is saying that the Adam HaRishon is able to use this light to perceive the world. This light is the light which enables a person to look misofa olam ad sofa olam, from one side of the world to the next, to give a deeper, more perceptive, more penetrating understanding of the way that reality works.
Right, it's true that Adam was a giant of a man.
No, it's not true. The medrash. These are all midrashim. These are all midrashim, and they are meant to be understood in a midrashic way. I don't think we are meant to understand that Adam HaRishon was some kind of, you know, enormous giant, you know, stomping around like a dinosaur around the, you know, ancient world. This is not what it's meant. When we talk, all these things talk about Adam HaRishon, they are all looking at different aspects of who was and what was Adam HaRishon. Would we even recognize Adam HaRishon if he came into the room today, or would he not even look physical to us? You know, therefore, I don't think it's right to have this sort of image of a sort of a jolly green giant sort of walking through Gan Eden. That's just not true.
Didn't everybody get smaller?
Yeah, well, everybody was
smaller. But again, where do we see this? These are midrashic ideas of people changing, but that reflects their spiritual status. Exactly how people physically looked, it doesn't say in the Pesukim that people started big and they got smaller. And say that. In fact, on the Hefach, over the last 1,000 years, people were small and they got bigger. So what does that mean? Whatever. I mean, the point is that we're not dealing with physicality here. All of this is, right. All of this is steering us away from any kind of physical understanding of this light.
But I thought that Adam and Chava, like, had the chait before Shabbos.
Yes, they did have the chait before Shabbos, but they were given a schus that they were able, through because of Shabbos, to continue living, if you like, that life preset until Motzei Shabbos, and then you're on your own. Yeah, they weren't expelled before Shabbos.
Yeah, because they thought that they were thrown out before Shabbos.
They
said if they had gotten to Shabbos, like Mashiach and
if they'd have eaten the tree on Shabbos, then that would have been good. That's what they bring down. If they'd have just managed to delay till Shabbos to actually eat the fruit, maybe that would have been the right thing to do. But my understanding is, I'm not an expert in these midrashim, my understanding is that whatever state they existed in, it only really kicked in, this exile on Motzei Shabbos for the Shabbos. They had this, if you like, they lived on this virtual reality plane that we have on Shabbos as well. But after Shabbos, they got it. Right. If you look at this 36 hours, is very relevant. Look at number 4, the Rokeach. Was one of the Rishonim, Umadlikim b'Chanukah Lamed Vav Neiros, 36 candles on Chanukah. Lama Lamed Vav Neiros, why 36 candles? Remez la Lamed Vav Shal Sheshimsha Ha'oyer b'Maseh Breishis. These are the 36 hours of the light that burned for Adam and Chava Maseh Breishis. Correct. 8 plus 7 plus 6 plus 5. We're not counting the Shamash. Obviously, that's not part of the Hanukkah candles. Therefore, if you add up 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, or the other way around, you will get to 36. So you already see here the Hanukkah lights are meant to be connected very clearly this spiritual light. Let's go further. This is the reason why, and here's the halachic bit, if you wanted some halacha, number 5, Shulchan Aruch says, Asa lishtamesh la'oira bein tashmish, kedusha bein tashmish chol. You're not allowed to use the Hanukkah lights, whether for a purpose of kedusha, to learn a sefer or something, or for a chol purpose, to do your accounts or to read a novel, whatever. You can't. Why? Even to check money. Okay? Oh, sorry, I missed it. I skipped to number 6. Number 5. Also, lishtamish b'nei Chanukah b'ein b'Shabbos b'ein b'chol. You're not allowed to use the lights of the Chanukah candles either on Shabbos or on the weekday. Afilu livdoik maos, even to count your money. Or limnois on the oira, or to count things out by the light, is os. You can't do that by the light. Afilu tashmish el kedusha could go milmud loira. Even learning by the light is also. Why are we so focused on not using the Hanukkah lights? There's even shilas. If you walk in a room and there's the Hanukkah lights burning, are you allowed to walk with your eyes open? You are. You don't have to close your eyes.
But can you like just look at them? And enjoy
you can look at. That's the point. Ein lahem, ein lanu rishus lehishtamesh bahem. We can't use them. El liroisam bilvav, just to look at them. They are designed for looking at, not looking with, if you like. And therefore you see the Ben Ish Chai, one of the more Kabbalistic Sephardi sources, in number 6, when he talks about this issa to use the Hanukkah light, says, Also Ishtamish La'ora Ben Tashmish Kudusha Ben Tashmish Chol. You're not allowed to use the light for a holy or a mundane purpose. And he gives a Kabbalistic reasoning. Or Kafi Hasoid, according to the Kabbalah, Im Ne'ne Ma'ora, if you benefit from the lights, Oisep Pagam Godel, you're making a serious error. It's making a real problem. You're creating a real negativity. Why? Sheit achsu hachitsoinim va'or elyon. Because the negative forces, external forces, and I want you to focus on this word chitsoini, external, not internal forces, begin to connect with the light. What does that mean? I don't really know because I'm not a Kabbalist, but we'll get a bit of an insight as to what maybe he's talking about when he's talking about using the light is creating an externality, a superficiality, which the Hanukkah lights dafka do not represent. Yes.
So should you light them in a room where you're not going to really do anything in that room, or it's fine if you have the regular light?
No, you can have the regular light on. What you shouldn't be doing is lighting them next to the table and playing dreidel by the light of the Hanukkah candle. That's just come like there's a misuse. By the way, you should know that the opposite, of course, is true of Shabbos candles. Shabbos candles are designed to be used, and therefore you must use them. And if you don't use Hanukkah Shabbos candles, then that's a problem.
How do you use them?
You use them by the table, you eat dinner by them, or you daven mincha by them, or etc., etc. Use them to create an ambiance, etc. The Hanukkah candles are not used to create anything, apart from just to be there to see and to think. We'll see why soon. Now, so far, light. What's this got to do with the Greeks? So if you look at number 7, the Haaretz Hayta Tohu, it's talking again about the creation. The world was void. Yeah, Zegolus Bavel. That is the Galut of Bavel. Uba Uvahu and empty, etc. The Zegolus Madai. This is the Golus of Madai that came after Bavel. V'choshech and darkness. This primeval darkness. Zegolus Yavan. This is the Greeks. Shehechshicha einehem shel Israel. They darkened the eyes of Israel. The Gezerosehem, through their Gezeros, it's very well known the kind of things they were particularly interested in doing, making Gezeros on were Bris Milah, Shabbos, Rosh Chodesh, Taras Mishpacha, etc. Shehaisa Oimeris Lahem, they would say to them, Kasu al Keren Hashor, write on the horn of an ox, Sheinachem Chelek, bless you, Be'elokei Israel. You have no Chelek in the God of Israel. And I want you to remember that word Chelek. As well, there's a few words I want you to keep at the back of your mind, or the middle of your mind. One is the chitzoni, the externality. And this is, they're telling them they have no chelek in the Elokei Yisrael. I'm not getting into exactly what the horn of the ox is now. That's not for now. Fine. And finally, apnei tahoim, on the depths, on the face of the depths, zegolas malchus harosha, mamleches harosha, that's Edom, Esav, the Romans, whatever. But you see that the Greeks are darkness. Okay.
We'll see.
By us as well, to some degree, but we'll see. We'll see. But there's something about them which is darkness, and of course we're lighting this light to bring out the light. Of course, the interesting thing is the light that we use is this olive oil, which is the mitzvah min hamuvcha, which is again the hidden. It's the or haganuz. It's the hidden light. You look at an olive and you don't see light. You see a little green fruit, but actually, if you give it a little squeeze, in it is light, and you never even knew. It just oozes out of it. And this is all part of the metaphor and the moshel for this idea of the hidden light. Now, we see, and I wanted to put all these ideas together, the Greeks of darkness, who are the light? Tzadikim. Number 8, Vayikra Elokim La'or Yom. He called the light day. Elu Masim Shel Tzadikim. This is the act of the Tzadikim. We saw in Rashi before that the light was set aside. This special spiritual light was set aside for the Tzadikim. And similarly, a very well known Posik, number 9, Or Zarua La Tzadik. Light is sown for the tzaddik. The tzaddik is associated with light, always. That's why, appropriately, there were 36 hours of light, there are 36 candles of Hanukkah, and there are Lamed Vav Tzadikim. It's the same idea, number 10. Amar Abaya, Loi Pochas Alma, Mitalsim Vashisa Tzadikim. There are never less than 36 Tzadikim, De Makabli Apish Shechina B'chol Yom, that are receiving the Shechina on every day. And he brings a pasuk from Yeshaya, which through a gematria, there's a hint to this idea of 36 Tzadikim. This is where it comes from. If you ever wondered why the word 36 led to the number 36, it's all related to this idea of Lamed Vav Sha'os, Lamed Vav Tzadikim, Lamed Vav Neiros. Fine. So far, everything has been pretty standard. I'm sure you'd have heard a lot of these ideas before. Now, something a little bit different. There's another kind of light. Chashmal. What's chashmal? Now it's electricity in modern Hebrew. There were a lot of people who were very unhappy with using the word chashmal for electricity.
Yeah, because it's
a very deep...
It's
a posik in Yechezkel. If you look in number 11, it says, Ve'era, I saw, says Yechezkel, this is his amazing image, etc. Ve'hine, ruach sa'ara ba minatzafon, there was a great storm coming from the north. Anan gadol, there was a great cloud. Ve'esh mitlakachat, there was a great fire, etc. Ve'noga lo saviv, and there was a light shining around it. Umitoichan, from in it, ke'ein ha'chashmal, there was chashmal, mitoichan ha'esh, inside the fire. Now, whether this has got anything to do with electricity, I've got no idea, but what exactly it means at all, I really have no idea. It's one of the deepest Kabbalistic visions ever had, but there was this vision of something coming towards him with a light shining around it. When the Zohar picks up this posik in Yechezkel and says, what is this Noga Saviv? The word Noga is a nice name, actually. My daughter has friends called Noga. It's a modern Israeli name, light. Okay, like Ora is also a name sometimes. So Noga is a name. Number 12, Noga Lo Saviv. There is a Noga around it. Interesting, I don't know if this is relevant, but the word Lo also, of course, is Gematria 36, but that's not for now. Da Ihu Malchus Yavam, says the Zohar, these are the Greeks. Desachralon Noga, because they have light around them. Veloi Bahu Noga, but they don't have light in them.
Wow.
Okay? Dichsiv Bahu Savi, because it says around them. So here we see something a little bit more subtle. The Greeks, of course, are darkness. We saw that. And the antidote is the Tzadikim, and the Greeks were Rasha'im, etc. However, the Greeks is not total darkness. There's a shining a light around the sign. What is that all about? And that's what I want to try and get to, really, in this particular presentation. Look at number 13. Another Zohar. Asher Ein Bo Mum. It's talking about the Para Aduma. The Para Aduma has to have, of course, the Para Aduma is the source of Tahara, is the source of purity, is the ultimate tool to remove impurity. And of course, again, there's a very strong theme with the Greeks and making the temple impure. And we have to purify the temple, etc. That, by the way, is one of the reasons why Hanukkah is 8 days. Because the ceremony of the Parah Adumah requires a 7-day preparation to be Mataher, things which are Tamei Meis, yeah? And only on the 8th day are you able to say things return to its purity. Anyway, Asher Ein Bo Mum, the Parah Adumah has to have no blemish, says the Zohar, Da Malchus Yavam. That is the Ein Bo Mum, there is no blemish in it, that is the Kingdom of Greece. The inhun kravim la'orcheim emnusa. They are close to the ways of Emunah. The Greeks are close to. They're bordering on. Yeah, again, this idea of the light around it. They are close to Emunah. What is Emunah? Emunah, of course, is the tzaddik. 14. Tzaddik be'emunaso yichya. It's the same idea, guys. Emunah is light. The tzaddikim are Emunah. The tzaddikim are light. Or the tzaddik, etc. The Greeks are not there, but they're close to there. They're close to being light. They're close to having emuna. And that's why the Zohar says in number 15, it's a bit of a difficult Zohar, language-wise, but it's I think it's a fairly straightforward idea. Number 15, Noga lo savi, when it says there's light around them. Mihacha ulifna, from here we learn, the afal gav the le sitra da, ela sitra de masavo, even though the force, the sitra, the side, if you like, the force of the Greeks, is ultimately a force which is tamei. Sava is tame. Nevertheless, noga lo saviv. There is a light around them. V'loy itzrich lei lebarnash ledachya lei lebar. You don't have to push it outside. And this is very interesting. What does that mean? It means that there's something about Greece which you don't have to totally push away, because there's something to it, even though it's coming from a negative place. My timer. What's the reason, says the Zohar? Begin the Nogal of it because it has a light around it. Sitra de Kedusha, there is an element of Kedusha, Dimnusa, Islay. There, it has a certain connection on some level to Kedusha and Emuna. Veloy Itzrichla and Hagabai Kali, you don't have to insult it, you don't have to deride it and push it completely to one side. Valda Itzrichle Maavle Chaluka, therefore you can give it something of a Chelek. The Sitra de Kedusha de Musa, together with the forces of Kedusha and the forces of Emunah. It can connect with this idea of the Chelek, and again, I wanted you to remember this word Chelek a little bit. Okay? There is an element of Kedusha that you can connect to it. How does this work? All these beautiful, lofty ideas. So let's link it now to the main posuk, I think. Number 16. Where does Greece come from? So Greece, Yavan, is the grandson of Yefet. Noah had three sons. Shem, Cham and Yefet. Okay? When they come out of the Teva, Cham, of course, disgraces his father. Well, Noah disgraces himself, really. But Cham kind of adds insult to injury. And he sees him rolling around naked, and he kind of laughs and whatever. He doesn't do anything about it. According to some Midrashic sources, he even abuses him and attacks him, whatever. Of course, Shem and Yafet come and they see, and they turn around, they turn their faces away, and they cover over their father in a very respectful way. As a result of this, Cham gets a klala, Cham gets a curse, and Shem and Yafet get a bracha. What are the brachas that they get? So Cham is given a curse, he's going to be an Eved, whatever, that's not for now. Number 16 says, Noach, Yaft Elokim LeYafet. Look at these words very carefully. Yaft Elokim LeYafet. God will give Yafet Yafet, Yaft. Obviously a play on words. What does Yaft mean? What's Yafa? Beauty. Yofi. Yeah? God will give beauty to Yefet. Ve'yishkon ba'ohel Hashem. And he will dwell in the tents of Shem. Who will dwell in the tents of Shem?
Yefet.
Or? Hashem. The posuk is ambiguous. God will give Yaft to Yefet, but he will dwell in the tents of Shem. So, Rashi, and brings the Targum Onklus, in number 17, there's Targum Onklus. Yafti Elokim li Yafet. God will give beauty to Yafet. The Yashri Shechintei, and will dwell, let his Shechina dwell, the Mishkan Eshem, in the tents of Shem. And that's what Rashi brings. But Yishkan Ba'ol Eshem means Yishra Shechinas of Israel. In other words, there's Yafet. Yafet has beauty. It's all very chitzoni. It's all very superficial. We have Shechina. We have the God dwelling in our tents. However, the Targum Yonason, which is a very ancient source, doesn't view the Pasuk that way. There's a big battle of the Targumim. Yeah? The Onkelos understands that God is dwelling in the tents of Shem. But look at Targum Yonason, number 19. Yishpar, from the word Shapir. Yeah? Yashpar Hashem, Tchumei the Yefet. Yefet, Hashem will make the dwellings, if you like, of God will make the dwellings of Yefet beautiful. The Yitgarun Banoi, and his children will live, the Yishrum B'Midrasha the Shem, and will come and live in the Beis HaMedrash of Shem. Meaning, it's Yefet that's going to come and live with Shem. Now, what's the difference between those two readings? Turn over the page to page 3. This is a very important idea. What place does Yefet have in the world? Are they out? They have beauty, but beauty is meaningless, and we have Torah. And Torah's important. Or do we try and make some kind of I don't want to use the word, but I'm going to use it anyway, synthesis. Okay, synthesis is the buzzword of the modern Orthodox Yeshiva University kind of Torah or Mada kind of thing. It's like the big word. You can do a whole PhD on the word synthesis. Do we try and make some kind of synthesis, or at least some kind of connection, let's say, between Yafet and Shem? It depends how you read this posuk. The Gemara picks up on this and actually reads it the way The Targum Yonason reads it. Says the Gemara in Megillah, Tfilin u'mezuzas einam nichtavim ela asheris. If you're writing Tfilin u'mezuzas, they have to be written in Hebrew. Okay? Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, oimer af besvarim, but with svarim, with Sifrei Torah, loy hitiru sheyichtavu ela yavanis. Which means that a Sefer Torah, according to Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, can be written entirely in Greek. Ancient Greek. In other words, if you write your mezuzas in ancient Greek, they're not kosher. If you write your Sefer Torah in ancient Greek, it's kosher. You can read it on Shabbos. Now the Rambam brings down, we don't have sufficient expertise in ancient Greek to be able to know exactly how to write it. But it's amazing, even one letter of the Sefer Torah in Hebrew is missing or faulty, the whole Sefer Torah's parcel has to be put away. But if the entire Sefer Torah is written in Greek, according to Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, it's completely kosher. Why? Why? What's with Greek? If you look at the Gemara, it explains this, it's in number 21. Amar Rabbi Abahu, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Halacha ke Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. The halacha is like Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. But I'm Rabbi Yochanan, my time of the Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. What is the reason of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel? I'm a cross, as the pasuk says, Yaft Elokim le Yefes v'ishkan ba'oyal Hashem. Dvarav shel Yefes yihiyu ba'oyal Hashem. The words of Yefes can live within the tents of Shem. That's why if you take Greek, and instead of writing Aristotle or Plato, you write a Sefer Torah, the Greek has been, if you like, raised up to a level of Kedusha, and this is a legitimate enterprise, says Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. This is, if you like, epitomized by the rather clever but simple joining of Yavan to the letter Tzadi. If you join Yavan and Tzadi, like I put on the sheet, you get Tzion. This is, I think, quite a well-known connection. But this is really expressing the same idea. Yavan in and of itself is external and is superficial and is beauty. But when, if you can put that, says the Gemara, in a context of shame, shame, then you raise it up to a level of Kedusha. This is what is they're talking about, where it has a light shining around it. In other words, it in and of itself is not or, is not emunah, but if you make it that, then you can make it that.
Tzadik.
You put the tzidkas into it. Look, this Yavan has a lot of stuff. It has chokhmah, it has intellectualism, it has philosophy. There's nothing wrong with any of that. What it doesn't have is tzidkas. We'll see what tzidkas is. A connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a connection with morals and ethics, etc. Once you put the tzadik, of course, who's the tzadik? It's the light. Or zaruah la tzadik. The tzadik is the emunah. Tzadik bi emunah binasu yichya. Once you connect the tzadik with Yavan, you have, if you like, the dream team. Tzion. Which is Kimitzion Tete Torah. Because then you can broadcast Torah to the world, because then you have a connection between these two things. This, I think, is also epitomized by a very famous Medrash, which is not just a Midrash, but it's actually an account, a historical account, of the meeting of two very special people. When Alexander the Great, and I brought you this, I'm not going to do the source, but I brought you this on your addendum, on your extra sources in 27. If you have it, you have it, but I'm not going to read it now, so you don't have to look at it. I'm going to read it in a minute. There was a very famous meeting that's brought down in the Gemara Numa between Alexander the Great and Shimon HaTzadik. You're familiar with that Medrash.
Right,
we talk about it in different situations. It's also brought down in Josephus, Flavius, in the Wars of the Jews, in Book 11, in Chapter 8,
I think.
Yes. Well, Josephus Flavius was not really a goy, he was a Jew, but he was kind of on the Roman side. But whatever, he's a complicated individual. But he records this in his Histories of the Jews, that there was this meeting. Alexander the Great marched on Israel, and he didn't conquer Israel. He walked peacefully into Jerusalem, and the Gemara in Yuma brings the account that he was about to attack Jerusalem, and Shimon HaTzadik and the Kohanim walked out of Jerusalem. He was wearing his big day kahuna. This is why the Gemara discusses it there, because it's discussing, are you allowed to wear big day kahuna outside the Beis HaMikdash? And Shimon HaTzadik did, and Alexander the Great got off his horse and bowed down to Shimon HaTzadik. And he said, and his general said, what are you doing? Who's this Jew? And he says, no, I see this face. I see this man in my dreams when I'm about to attack in a war. I see this man and he gives me chizuk. Okay? And Alexander and Shimon HaTzadik said, yes, we daven for you in Yerushalayim. We daven that you should be matzliach. So why are you coming to destroy us? Come into the temple. And he brings down the decay, or rather the Gemara doesn't, but Josephus brings down that Alexander went in, he brought a korban in the base of Mikdash, and they bring down that year everyone called their sons Alexander. That's how Alexander became a Jewish name, and it covered for Alexander the Great. But if you understand this story of Alexander bowing down to Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon HaTzadik is called Shimon HaTzadik for a reason. Mm-hmm. It's the Tzadik and the Yavan connecting. It's the Yavan, it's Yaftelikim v'yafes v'yishkum ba'oil Hashem. That's what this medrash is talking about. That Shimon HaTzadik is the Tzadik and Yavan is becoming connected with him. And together they're an unbelievable force, an unbelievable power. On their own, of course, Yavan is just sort of krumkite, as it were. That's true, and that's the Tumah. Look at Rav Tzadok HaKohen number 22. Asher ein bo mum, there's no blemish in it. Zum Malchus Yavan, he's quoting the Zohar. V'chein ita b'Zohar Chadash Yisrael, he's quoting the Zohar. Noga b'saviv, da Malchus Yavan. The light around it is the Malchus Yavan. The Sachre le Noga, there's light around it, there isn't light in it. Why? Begin the leis b'chol malchun de inhun krevim le'orchun emnusik kavafei, he quotes the Medrash there. V'hainu, Shehem b'chachmas Yavanis he'emidu derech yashar b'midos. Through chachmas Yavanis, through Greek wisdom, they established a certain correct way of thinking, the right way of understanding things. Yeah, mashenah be'olam hazeh lahanhaga, which is very suitable and fitting for this world. Think what the Greeks brought. We'll see Rav Hirsch in a minute. What the Greeks brought to the world, they brought intellectualism in a world which was pagan and mad and vulgar and uncivilized. So the Greeks were also pagan. They weren't exactly monotheists, but they brought a certain civilizing thought. That rather than walking around chopping people's heads off with axes, they said, well, let's sit and think about the world and try and resolve the world that way. And that, says Rav Tzadok, of course, is a very, very special and admirable thing. And we see, says Rav Tzadok HaKohen, that our own Chachamim brought from the works of the Greeks. There's no one who's more into the thinking of the philosophy of Aristotle than the Rambam, in terms of the bringing that into Jewish ideas. Many, many aspects of the Moreh Nevuchim use Aristotelian, and in some cases Platonic, understandings of the world to answer Jewish questions. And the Rambam himself says that Aristotle reached the highest level of intellect that a human being can ever have, short of Nevuah. Because at the end of the day, he wasn't a tzaddik. He was an intellectual. It's only when you put it together with the tzaddik that you end up with emes. Okay? That's why the Rambam in the Shemoneh Prakim, I brought this also on the addendum. Look, I do want you to see this. Look at number 32 on the extra sources. If you have it, you can share with me for a second. I don't have another one. He says, da. When he's talking about where he's going to bring his Perushim on Pirkei Avos. Shehadvarim asher amar b'prakim eilu, the things that are going to be said in these chapters, einam dorim shebedisim ma'atzmi, are not things I made up. V'loy perushim shechidashtim, and they're not stuff that I just originated now. Amnon heimim yanim l'kutayim, they're things that I gathered, v'divrei chachamim, from the words of the rabbis, the midrashos, from the midrashim, the Talmud, from the Talmud, v'zulasa mehachivreyim, the chibureyim, and all the other things the rabbis wrote. Umidivre ha-philosophy. And also, he says, from the works of the philosophers. Gamken, ha-kadmoni v'ha-chadashim, the older ones and the earlier ones. He brings from Islamic philosophers. He brings from Greek philosophers. Umichibure harbe b'nei Adam, from many different people. Why? V'shma ha-emes mi-misha amra. Because you listen to truth, whoever says it. Now, that's a little bit of a controversial statement. So we'll see that. I'm going to bring that source in a minute. But says the Rambam, truth is truth, whoever said it. But of course, without bringing it into Torah, it remains external. Look at the end of Rav Tzadok HaKohen number 22. Ach, however, b'shoyrish chachmason, at the root of the chachma of the Greeks, who minis gemura, is complete apikorsis, is complete heresy. Because they discovered that Aristotle, Haroshel Abahem, the head of the Greek thinking, he was a disgusting individual. He was full of taiva. The Greeks were not known to be moral people. They were steeped in homosexuality and immorality. And they weren't interested in preaching a moral lifestyle, necessarily. Or the way we would say. Yes, the whole thing, yeah. V'zehu sha'achakach, the whole Olympic Games, and nakedness, and the body beautiful, that was the way they put it. V'zehu sha'achakach kosu v'parsa lo hifrisa, when it talks about the pig, that it doesn't have, it has a cloven hoof, or it doesn't have a cloven hoof. There's a different simonim of treifas, etc. Shebeshorish yesh lo hatuma besimon haniglois. Okay, there's different tumas and there's different tara. Some things have an internal tara and an external tuma. Some things have an external tuma and an internal tara, etc., etc. So he says the Greeks, really, they are deep-rooted, they are very tame. But they still do have this chokhma, which is very choshev and very important. I want you to look at Rav Hirsch for a second. And I want to just bring selectively from Rav Hirsch. This is taken from the collected writings. Turn to the page which it says 202. I'd wrote this in English, obviously it's in translation. I didn't think it was worth bringing the original German for any of us. But I want you to see what he says. If ever you feel that Hanukkah is like people are doing like a job on the Greeks and how awful the Greeks were, open this Rav Hirsch and see what he says. Hellenistic thought stimulates the mind and soul and aims to develop through joy and knowledge and pleasure in all that is noble, harmony and beauty as weapons to suppress brutish outbursts of passions. It makes him responsible to himself, expects him to ennoble himself by self-control, by doing away with all that is evil and vulgar, attributes that disturb the divine harmony in character and in sentiment, in speech and in deed. The Hellenistic spirit creates civilized, gentle, joyful, and free men. Should we not rejoice in the fulfillment of the ancient prophecy Yafel Akimli Yefes? God will open the mind of Yefes. Should we not, he used the word Yaf, not as beauty, but as Yifateh, to entice, okay? He will open the mind of Yefes. Should we not rejoice in the power displayed by this Hellenistic culture, which has gained increasingly control over the minds of men by suppressing all that is vulgar and by stimulating the enjoyments of beauty? By measuring sensual beauty as a standard for self-perfection, which develops nobleness of character, it fosters a loathing of the vulgar as a mortal danger to morality. The Hellenistic spirit appeals to the godly spark in the human breast and encourages the human mind to perfect its self-perception to the recognition of the greatness of intellectual pursuits and science and guarantees man's spirit of individual freedom. Like, just read that on its own. You'd think that Hanukkah is a celebration of everything that's Greek. Yeah? Right, absolutely. We see this. We see this in democracy. We see that. And none of these things are perfect, of course. But they are not evil. They take mankind to a shlav, to a level which is far beyond where mankind was before the Greeks came along. Look at the bottom paragraph there. And yet, and this is the end yet, which is so critical.
True, are the Jews of the time as well?
Let's see. And yet Hellenistic culture contains only a small fraction of the truth which will eventually affect the salvation of mankind. As long as Hellenism is not coupled with the spirit of Shem, as long as it prides itself on being the sole road to happiness, it falls prey to error, illusion, degeneration, and decay. Hellenistic culture stimulates only the mind, creates only a thirst for knowledge and truth, but is unable to generate knowledge of truth. Interesting, it's a thirst for knowledge, but not knowledge of truth. There's no MS. The mind revels in notions and suppositions, forms ornate and hypothetical assumptions in order to solve the riddle that faces. And then he goes into a whole page of how Hellenism on its own is not sufficient. And that's the mistake that the Mityavnim made. The Jews at the time embraced Hellenism as an end in and of itself.
And they lost themselves.
Because it's so enticing. Because it's so appealing to Jews. Because it's so civilized and it believes in thinking and it believes in self-perfection. Jews are not going to be attracted to living like animals. Because that's not where they're genetically coming from. That's not where they're spiritually coming from. They're deeply attracted to Hellenism. Because Hellenism is so enticing in this way. And that's how the Jews lost themselves. And that's the reshut.
Therefore it's so much more dangerous to have something that has a kernel of MS in it.
Yes. Yes, and that at the end of the day has been the machloikis in Hashkofa over the last 150 years between three major worldviews, which is the worldview of the Haredi Olam, which is that basically this is dangerous and needs to be pushed away. Maybe you can dabble in it if you need to for Paranossa, if you really have to. You can actually use it to earn money because you've got to earn money, ain kemach, ain Torah. Yeah? But it's basically poseltreif because it's so dangerous that you don't want to get involved. And it's been the downfall of Jews for millennia. Rav Hirsch, in what they often call neo-orthodoxy in the 1850s, said, no, there's a Torah in Derech Eretz. What he's really basically saying here is Torah in Derech Eretz, which is not their equals at all. He doesn't believe in synthesis. He believes that Derech Eretz, Yavan, Greek wisdom and philosophy and thinking is a basis, is a foundation for Torah. If it's used in order to get to Torah, it can ennoble Torah, it can make Torah, give it a foundation, give it a firm footing, and it can create a really top Jew. Torah im Derech Eretz. If there's Derech Eretz there as well, Torah will be planted on firm foundations. And that's really what he's saying. He's saying Hellenism is a step towards Shem. But Torah is definitely the pinnacle. They don't stand side by side. One is a means to the other. And you can, I'll leave you to read. There's this beautiful, beautiful stuff by Rav Hirsch here. Oh, I'm getting there in a second. One second. Just turn for a second before I use the third world view, and let's focus on Torah Derech Eretz for a second. Look to where it says, go back to page 200. We were reading from 202 just now. Go back to 200. Chanukah, when I put the line on the side, Chanukah represents the clash of two doctrines, two views, two civilizations, capable of molding opinions, training and educating those who to this very day compete for the mastery of the world, Hellenism and Judaism. They are two forces which effect on the nations, whose effect on the nations mark the historical development of mankind, and which serves to Judea for the first time in the days of Matthew. Hellenism and Judaism, when examined in depth, they are the two leading forces which today are again struggling for mastery in the Jewish world. You should read Winston Churchill. He talks about Athens and Jerusalem. Athens and Jerusalem have together brought the Western world to where it is today. The thinking, the science, the philosophy of secular development, and the morality and civilization of the Western world. I think of the Jewish world, which is very much part of the Western world. The Western world is based on Jewish ideas. Don't murder, don't steal, yeah, be moral, be ethical. I often think that the Olympic Games is a very interesting expression of this duality. Because the Olympic Games in and of themselves are very Greek. We believe in who can run fastest and who's the most beautiful. We'll have beauty competitions and we'll parade people around on stage to look as more beautiful than the next one. But then, of course, in the last few years, they've started with the Paralympics. What's the Paralympics? The Paralympics is for people who are paralyzed, for people who are disabled. They have wheelchair races and they have people on crutches and I'm actually running. It's incredible. It's incredible. People with no legs and people with no arms and things like that. Why do they introduce the Paralympics? So, this is my view. I think the Paralympics is the Yiddishkeit in society saying the Olympics is not really what it's all about. You know, we don't value people through how fast they can run. We value people through what they achieve in their lives and through who they are and the Pnimius in the people, not the Akitsonius in the people. And I think that the Olympics and the Paralympics are like this attempt to try and come to terms with who are we, Athens or Jerusalem? And it's like a very interesting clash. And look over the page in 201. The domination of minds by Yafetic culture would only be the groundwork for the houses of men into which God portrayed by Shem would move and find his place on earth. At first, minds will be receptive to Japhetic culture, and then Shem's God would enter into the Testament. This is Torah in Derech Eretz at its best. Japhet, then Shem. The third worldview, of course, is the worldview of Torah Umada. Torah Umada is definitely not Torah in Derech Eretz. Torah Umada, which is a synthesis of Judaism, of Torah, and non-Jewish philosophy and thought and etc., humanities, whatever it is, believes in it, if you like, two systems running side by side. And each one is not perfected without the other one. You can read Norman Lamb's book, Professor, Rabbi, Dr. Norman Lamb, don't want to give and take away titles, called Torah Umada. He sets out there the idea of Torah Umada, which is definitely not the same as Rav Hirsch, and does not hold that Yefet is just a foundation, but that the two go together and they synthesize with each other. And that is modern orthodoxy and the philosophy of
Derech Eretz Kadma Torah. Is that the same idea?
So this is where Rav Hirsch is coming from. Derech Eretz Kadma la Torah. Derech Eretz is a preparation for Torah, but not an alternative.
In English.
What's that? Yes, it is. You can buy it from Pomerantz bookshop, but it's very expensive. It's like
L-E-M-M.
It's like 350 shekels or something for a little book like that. But it's worthwhile getting hold of a copy from the library. Why? Because there's not many prints. I think it's such a bestseller in Yerushalayim. But the place to get it probably is New York. When you're next in New York, pick it up at YU. I'm sure they've got 1,000 copies. When I was reading it...
You'd say Rabbi Hirsch before
the Hirsch. Definitely. You read his collected writings, and you can read his Perush HaLechumash and Chorev, and these things state these. But Chanukah is really where Rav Hirsch sees the foundation of the term Derech Eretz.
And it's already involved in the term.
Yes, term. And Derech Eretz, at best, is the need to earn a parnasa. That's why you see that Hanukkah is often just the sort of the Greeks and the nasty old Greeks, because what value do the Greeks have if the culture of Yafa? I'm not saying ignore them, but how often do you go to Shirim where they bring them?
But I'm saying, how God is the free world then reject all of this stuff.
I don't agree with it. You don't have to agree with that first. You
rather. What's the argument for disagreeing?
But there's like the Zohar.
There are all these sorts like, what is the argument
against it? But they say that everything's in Torah. What are you talking about?
The argument against this is that they have a light. Yeah, but they have a light. But the light is, you know, who? Maybe if you're Shimon HaTzadik, maybe you can connect with Alexander the Great. But if for us, we're not able to get into that, and there's too much it's too treif, and it just will affect us. It's true in many ways. There's a practical argument, which is that people cannot basically do this. And this has been going for years and years and years. In Spain, after the age of philosophy, in the 1200s, the 1100s and the 1200s, they made a ban. The Rashba, made a ban on learning philosophy until the age of 25. Why? Because there were whole generations of young men in Spain who were going off the derech because of philosophy. Now, today people don't go off the derech because of philosophy. People go off the derech for 100 other reasons, but none of them to do with philosophy. Okay? But
why is that?
Okay, that's a whole different discussion, which isn't, I'm not sure I have anything useful to add to the debate. But anyway, that's a different question. But in their day, philosophy was seen as dangerous, and that's why there was a swing against philosophy. And the world of Kabbalah also is not necessarily a philosophical world, etc. Who learns Mori Nebuchim? The Rambam has been beautifully cut into two people. There's the Rambam and there's Maimonides. The Rambam we learn, Maimonides we don't. Okay? It's a beautiful incision through the middle of the Rambam. And of course, if you go to YU, there is no such division. The Rambam is Maimonides, and Maimonides is the Rambam. And you can't understand Maimonides without understanding the Rambam, and vice versa. Whether you separate these two worlds or whether you try to connect them, that is one of the big debates of our time. Let me just finish with a couple of little things.
Where are you
going to
talk to the third?
Oh, that is the third one. Torah Umada. Torah Umada. There's Torah Oni. There's Torah in Derech Eretz. And the Torah Umada. People make a lot of the Im and the U. The Rav Hirsch is Torah Im Derech Eretz. Not Torah U Derech Eretz. Where it's Torah Umada. That's the shield of why you
Torah Umada and Midrashi World
in Eretz. No, there's Midrashi World in Eretz Israel. It's too oversimplistic to associate the two. The Midrashi World in Eretz Israel is coming from a world of Rav Kook, which is a world which is not a world of Torah Umada at all. It does definitely value secular education in a way that the standard Haredi model doesn't, but it sees it in the clothing of a messianic revival in Eretz Israel. And it's part of Mashiach ben Yosef, which is a whole messianic. There's nothing messianic about Torah Umada. But there is something very messianic about religious Zionism within Eretz Israel, and the whole worldview is based on that. There is an overlap, but it's not right. People often make the mistake saying, well, these guys wear kippot shragon, and these guys wear kippot shragon, they must be all the same. It's definitely not the case. Just like everyone who wears a black kippah is not the same either. Yeah.
So, I'm just a little confused. You're saying Torah Umada is not...
No, chas v'chalila. I'm not saying what's good and what's not good.
I am not saying anything.
I am saying that there are three worldviews.
Wait, I don't understand what is Torah Umada.
We touched in great, in very small. I got to give you a whole sheer. And we can look at Norman Lamb's works and look at that 15 different extracts to try and understand. I'm not expecting to try and give you justice. I'm going to talk about Hanukkah. I'm not talking about Torah Umada and Torah Umada, Torah Umada. I'm just mentioning Agav. The fact that you're confused, okay, it's my fault. I didn't get a chance to explain properly. I'm sorry. But, you know, if you want, I'll send you my sheet on Torah Umada, Eretz, and Torah Umada. And you can look at what I wrote there and you can see the sources and you can read it and get, you know, or you can go read Norman Lamb's book and then you'll know what Torah Umada is. You can't do it in sound bites. You know?
I thought Torah Umada was just religious, and sometimes you'll read the paper.
No, that's the man on the streets view of Torah Umada. That's not Rav Soloveitchik's understanding of what Torah Umada is meant to be. You're religious, but you go to the cinema.
Which one is Rav Soloveitchik?
Torah Umada. Founded a university, it was at YU. Whether Rav Soloveitchik students.
I thought people said that he was huge. Oh, look, to be more modern.
There's always a revisionism. whenever people are Talmidim, so they take the view of the Rebbe that they had, and some of them take it further in that direction, some of them move it back. And look, the truth is Rav Soloveitchik wrote a lot of his own works. You can read them for yourself, and you can take a view as to what he understands as being. There's no question that Rav Soloveitchik in his life was not what you call today modern Orthodox. That's like, because we're already 100 years later. Rav Soloveitchik was born 100 years ago. Of course he was believed in something which was modern Orthodox, but that's not like the vision of modern Orthodox that people have today, which is, I'm modern Orthodox, which means that I'm from, but, it's always a but, I do this and I do that. Right, but so is modern Orthodoxy really Orthodox? It's just that things have moved to change.
Not just the foundation, but it is like there.
Right. And you need to read Hirsch properly, you need to read Norman Lamb properly, and then you'll get an understanding. I'm just linking it in with Hanukkah and seeing that this Greek issue is really the underlying issue. It's not a clear question. Let me just finish with just one little thing. I think the reason really why, if you like, coming back to your question, whose question, like what's wrong, who's asking what's wrong with, yeah. So look at the last three, four sources on the sheet in number page 3, and you'll see a little bit what I think is coming from. One of the reasons that there's a sort of anti-Greek emphasis, and that's real, is because the Greeks really also caused a great deal of damage. Look at number 23, Shir HaShirim, says the Pasuk, Ani Choyma, I am a wall. What does it mean, I am a wall? So look at what the Shir HaShirim, what the Medrash says here. Amru Yisrael ifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Jewish people said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono Shel Olam, Anu Choyma, we are a wall. For now mid mitzvahs, we will erect mitzvahs, Umasim tovim, and good deeds, kachoma, like a wall. We are a barrier. We are a wall of morality. We represent an uncompromising moral view, which the Greeks, frankly, were just not interested in. They were not interested in that level of morality. And we are. And therefore, that's why it says in number 24, Ma'atsori, Yevanim nikbatsu alai, the Yevanim ganged up on us, and they broke through the wall of my towers, and they made all of the oil tame, all of this oil, this light which represents the tzaddikim and the emuna and the kedusha, they broke through the wall. That's why the Mishnah says, look at number 25. In the Beis HaMikdash, at the end of the Second Temple period, there was a little fence called a Sarug, quite short, just 10 tefachim high. There were 13 gaps in that wall. Shepirtzu Malchei Yavon, because the Greeks broke through in 13 places. Chazru v'gadru, they built them up again. V'gadru kenegdam shalosh esrei hishtachavayos. And what they used to do, there was a service in the temple at the end, after the Hanukkah story had all finished, and they come back, they had 13 special bowing downs that they did in the temple, hishtachavayos, at these 13 gaps, representing, if you like, the mending of the breach, the mending of the wall that the Greeks broke down. And what did they break? And they tried to blur the distinctions. There's no distinction between Jews and non-Jews. This havdalah. Look at number 26, we'll finish. Shehula tet mokum. What do these breaches mean? The tet mokum la havdil ben oivdi kachavim v'hanichnasim hispalav beis Hashem ubein Yisrael. This srug, this little wall of 10 tefachim high. The only purpose, or the main purpose of this wall, is this is the wall up to which non-Jews may go and beyond which they may not go. Jews may go beyond that wall. And there was a sign up, and they discovered the sign, the archaeologists, in Greek. Because they put it right in Hebrew. In Greek, for the non-Jews, saying, you are kindly requested not to go beyond this line unless you are Jewish. Yeah? Etc. Well, I probably didn't say you were kindly requested. In England, it would have said that. Okay. Shebishvil kena yevanim pirtsu kol boi pirtsus. Why did the Greeks break through this wall? Hoil benasev ahavdel oisam miboy yosem mitni. Because it was the thing that prevented them from becoming inside. Ulekach kashechazi Yisrael. Therefore, when the Jews came back, vazochu legadram, and they built back this barrier, tiknu akol gedeh hishtach havaya. They made a ceremony to bow down. Lahoidas Hashem ki toif, to thank God. And that's really what Chanukah is all about. It's a festival of thanksgiving, thanking HaKadosh Baruch Hu for Kedusha. It's all about Kedusha, Tzadikim, Or HaPnimi, Or HaGnuz, etc., etc. So Chanukah, just to summarize, has within it this very interesting dichotomy. On the one hand, it really is a celebration of the victory of morality and ethics, and Lahavdil Ben Kodesh L'chol, this distinction between profane and secular and Kodesh, which the Greeks wanted to break down. We're all human beings, we're all equal. Yeah? The Torah is just another book. We'll translate it into Greek and put it on the shelf. On the other hand, the Greeks had and brought to the world and to the Jews this incredible kayach of human wisdom and thinking and autonomy. That the people would be able to think for themselves and work things out for themselves. It's, you can read Rav Tzadok HaKohen at length. It's no coincidence that it's only when Alexander the Great and the Greeks came to Yerushalayim that what we call today Torah Shebaal Peh and all the Shakel of Atari and the analysis and the thinking, that's when it all really got going in big time. Of course, there was Torah Shebaal Peh before, they came from Sinai. But it really only took its modern form when the Greeks and the Greek methodological systems came in to the Jewish people. Therefore, you know, we have a lot to thank the Greeks for, in a sense, and we have a lot of connection with the Greeks. On the other hand, we want to keep a barrier from the Greeks. And as I said, these three different modern philosophies represent this attempt in today's world to try and come to terms with how to.
Not all of it,
but a lot of the systems that we use. In analysis, read Rav Tzadok HaKohen. Torah Shebaal Peh comes from Sinai. The ideas come from Sinai, they come from Moshe Rabbeinu. But the system of learning Torah Shebaal Peh, which is autonomous, which is like men, the rabbis creating new. When did all the Ditzas Derabbanan really start? They really only kicked off after the Second Temple period. This is a bigger subject which I can't get into now, which is also connected with this. It's no coincidence that the Medrash says that Nevuah, prophecy, stopped the day that Alexander walked into Yerushalayim. Because one system had stopped, another system had started. And therefore, you know, the Greeks and the Jews have got a lot in common, as well as a lot not in common. And, you know, there's a lot more you can go and read for yourselves after this class, in different ways. But I just wanted to bring to your attention this kind of, what's the word? Dichotomy, almost, as to how we view the Greeks. All right, that's it for now.